Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this evening. Welcome here to WEAA and a Free Speech TV. We have a great treat in store for you this hour. The wonderful, lovely, great Sonia Sanchez is with us in studio. We'll come back to that conversation right after. For our local listeners, we turn this over to WEAA Traffic. Check on the roads here in the Baltimore metropolitan area. And all of you around the country, just wait. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are just deeply honored today to have somebody whose work I have read for years and followed for years joining us here on the flap of her new book called Morning Haiku. It says about Sonia Sanchez, award-winning poet, activist, scholar, the Laura Carnell Professor of English and Women's Studies at Temple University, who won both the Robert Frost Medal and for Distinguished Lifetime Service for American Poetry and the Langston Hughes Poetry Award. But that doesn't even begin to say anything about Sonia Sanchez, who is one of America's great poets, who is the voice and soul of American culture. Some people say black culture. I say American culture. Who is just an amazing fighter for human rights, civil rights, political justice, against sexism, against racism, to build a better world for all of us. She's in town here because she is one of the 20 Freedom Sisters, which is a traveling exhibition which is now at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, and it is part of the Smithsonian Museum and Cincinnati Museum, and she's in town to celebrate that, and we celebrate her this hour on our program. And Sonia Sanchez, welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's good being here, my brother.
It's great to have you here.
Right, thank you.
Y'all can join us at 410-319-8888. And if you have a cell phone, before we get our 800 number installed, that is a free call for you, so do it. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. That is quite an honor, these women that you
were. Oh, gosh. Oh, yes. You know, I always tell the story, and the people kind of always sigh when I tell it, you know, the people from the Cincinnati Museum and the Smithsonian. But I got a call one day, and I was sitting in my study working, and I picked up the phone, and it was someone from the Cincinnati Museum saying simply that I had been chosen to be part of this exhibit going around. So I said, just, and who are the other women? And then they gave a list of women, you know, Sister Ella Baker, you know, Miriam Bethune, Shirley Chisholm, Septima Clark, Kathleen Cleaver. I said, hold it. I said, hold it. I can give you at least 100 other names where this will work much better. And then there was this great silence, a grand silence, actually. And she said, well, do you want to be a part of this or not, Professor Sanchez? And I said, no, I do. I just want you to know that I do consider it an honor. But there are so many women, you know, who also have done and are doing the work also, too, who could also be a part of it. And then she said something interesting. She said, you know, we also know that we need a writer. Quite often they honor women, and there are no writers any place in there. So it is indeed an honor, and I accept it, you know, for all those women writers, you know, who are out there writing, doing things. Things in the world.
And so many of these women who are on this list are women who have been great heroes of the struggle for civil rights and in this country, many of whom have passed away.
Oh, yes.
Dorothy Height, we lost this year.
That's right.
In April.
Just in April. And we were just together. We had been together the last time. I think it was in Alabama, at the Civil Rights Museum, you know. So at some point you just look up, and you know she's not there. And so we went to Jimmy Carter's, President Carter's library there, and we had the exhibit there. You know, you kind of turn around and look for. In the book I have some haiku to some of the Freedom Sisters.
Yes, you do. Yes.
And the one that I have for our dear sister, in fact, I actually wrote something that I'll probably read tomorrow for her. But for Dr. Dorothy Height, I said, your words helped us reconnoiter the wonder of women. And then, two, woman sequestered in the hurricane of herstory. Mm. And I added, another, and God held out his welcome hand. You said, what can I do to help? I mean, that was she, you know, always. And then I added the other night, verte e no verte, to have seen you and see you no more, you know, that's what I felt in Atlanta. I mean, of course, you know, she was there in the exhibit, but one always expected to see Dr. Height, you know, there with her magnificent hat on. And quite often she'd be talking, and then she'd lean back. I always say she would lean back on her eyes, right? And her eyes would close. And I remember we were at lunch once, and she leaned back on her eyes, and I was sitting next to her. So I was saying, you know, and someone said something. You know how people start to talk, like, let me now give you all this information that I have. Mm-hmm. And so this person did that, and then Dr. Height opened her eyes and said, no, that didn't happen then. That happened on this date. Now, I knew the young man was talking, that I knew he had the wrong date, right? But I didn't want to, you know, how you don't want to embarrass people. Right. But at 98, and, you know, she was 98 years of age when she made transition, a 98-year-old sister woman could say, no, that happened on this date. But what's amazing that she had that still in her head. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, no.
I mean, here I am thinking, now, I know that's the wrong date. Now, what was really the date, right? And she opened her eyes and said, no, that was December 5th, you know. I went, whoa. Everybody in the room looked up, and you realize, you know, that she was never asleep.
And you wrote another one to a woman who whose nephew was on the show yesterday.
Merle Evers?
Fannie Lou Hamer.
Oh, yes. But that, our dear sister Fannie Lou was an amazing woman. And what I wrote for her is, for Fannie Lou Hamer, feet deep in cotton, you shifted the country's eyes. You know, I mean, she came out of that cotton, you know, that cotton territory, that cotton country, that cotton state, that cotton territory. And she made the country shift. I mean, she did that, because I remember her as a Freedom Democrat, you know.
Mississippi Freedom Democrat.
Oh, yes.
1964.
Yes. And I remember her, you know, shaking up that whole meeting at some point, saying, you know, simply, no, we are indeed Democrats, and we are from Mississippi, and we have a right for a voice. So, you know, you don't want to do the obvious with them, you know, with them at all, but you want to do those things that at some point, like for Betty Shabazz, I said, your quiet face arrived at a road unafraid of ashes. And that, you know, alludes to a number of things there, you know, her husband and her own death as such, you know. So I think at some point you want to do something, you know, much more subtle than saying, you know, you were, you know, this, et cetera, you know. But that's, and Barbara Jordan, who was always a singular woman, right?
Oh, that voice, I can still hear her.
Yes. And so I, you know, so she was like a star. So I said, Texas star carrying delicate words around your waist. You know, what was interesting when she spoke, I mean, she had a strong voice, but there was a delicacy to her words that I always heard. You know, people always, you know, think you have to scream, mm-hmm. but she never screamed at mm-hmm. all, you know? Yeah.
Very clear.
Yeah, very, very clear. And, of course, Charlene Hunter Gault, who is coming back to the States in January down at University of Georgia, you know, because it'll be the 50th anniversary when they integrated. That's she and I can't think of
it. Right.
She and that young brother integrated
right.
that school, so they're going to honor her. And they asked me to come down also and speak. So for Charlene Hunter Gault, I wrote, summer silk woman brushing the cobwebs off southern legs. You know, if you've ever seen her, she's a summer silk woman.
Yeah.
So you try to be very, very clear about who these women are and, you know, and what they do and what they have done.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a bit about haiku?
Oh, yes.
Because many people hear the word but don't really have their hands around what haiku is.
Right. Well, you know, I have a two-page beginning on the haiku here.
In the book,
In the book, saying that when I first discovered that haiku, I was studying with a woman by the name of Louise Bogan, who was a well-known American poet at that time. If you go through all the anthologies, you'll see Louise Bogan. She was also the editor, the poetry editor of The New Yorker at the time. So she was teaching a class at NYU. I had graduated from Hunter, and I was going to NYU for graduate school. But I liked writing. So I looked in the catalog, and lo and behold, I saw this. I didn't even know her at the time. I didn't register. I just went and sat at the door because I'd been in these classes where I'd raise my hand and say something, and I was completely ignored. People forget that poetry was for men before. That's it. Men. Women were not involved. Arjen Rich tells the story, the great poet tells the story, that she went up to a very famous poet at Columbia, I think Columbia University, and said, "I want to be a poet." He said, "Oh, my dear, why would you want to be a poet? You are the poem." You know, so, you know, so I love when she said, so Arjen says in his essay, she says, "So when I saw these black poets get up on stage and take control of a stage and say, I am a black woman poet. She said, "I was able to get up and say, I am a woman poet." I mean, that connection that we've made, you know, here. So this haiku is something that Bogan would have us write, choose a form and write. And I went into the 8th Street bookstore and I was looking at some of the journals and some of the poetry in there, trying to figure out what in the world was I going to do. And I looked up, I saw this flowered book, beautiful flowers. And I had to pull one of the stools, and I reached up and got it. And I got off the stool and I opened to this beautiful haiku, and I literally slid down on the floor and cried. And then I got up and then I asked the guy, how do you pronounce this? Is this how you pronounce it? And he says, "Yes, haiku." And I said, "Well, thank you." And I went back and I sat down in there and I read. So I started to write that haiku because I had found me, as I say in that essay. I found me, you know, understanding at some point that that nature and I were one and the same. So when we began to teach the haiku, of course, what we did simply was that we taught it the way that that it was written in books, you know, five, it's three lines, five. The first line is five syllables, the second is seven, and the third is five, for a total of 17 syllables, right? And what I found out later on is that that those 17 syllables were trying to approximate, you know, the sound of the Japanese haiku. You know, you know, you couldn't capture that sound, but that was as close to the sound as you could get, right? And so that's why we did 17 syllables. And one day I was home and I got this letter from, it was from Japan. And I opened it and some people, so a man wrote me saying simply that we understand that you work with the haiku, and we read some of your haiku, and we'd like for you to be a part of this haiku. They were doing like a haiku, when you do one poem after the other. Why am I blanking?
In
other words, like they sent me the ones that had been written, and I would say add to it, right?
Okay, gotcha, right.
And so I carried that letter around with me for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then finally I was able to do it. But in doing it and looking at what was there, I also had another appreciation about the haiku. And what I learned about the haiku, the way I teach the haiku, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years, is not counting syllables, right? But the point is that it is as long as it takes you to say that haiku is how long the haiku should be. Usually the middle line is the longest line, right? But the point of the haiku is not 17 syllables. The point of the haiku, indeed, is the sound and the intent, you know, and the content of it. And by that, I mean simply that, you know, it is indeed what I call that great image, that beautiful image that you see there, and you're going to capture it like a snapshot. You know, you grab it and your eye catches it, and your fingers, your hands, you know, write it down, and you have that great, great image. But I did a long essay, it's going to be in a collection of my essays, about the intersection of the haiku and the blues.
And the blues.
Right? I laugh because, you know, people always say, "What is that, Sonia?" But I always say just how how alike they are, the blues and the haiku, how similar they are. Most of the times they have those three lines, you know, that we also understand. Although I belong to American Haiku Society and we're doing haiku with two lines. This book ends with two-line haiku. But what we talk about is that I learned from writing the haiku that my nature and the nature that is outside of my body, the nature that is nature, they're one and the same. I end up by saying something, you know, in the short piece. I said, and I found out that my mouth and the river are one and the same, because what I say in here simply is that, you know, what I'm trying to do when I teach young people what I call the haiku mind, and what Patricia Donegan talks about the haiku mind too, is the simple yet profound way of seeing our everyday world and living our lives with the awareness of the moment expressed in haiku, and to therefore hopefully inspire others to live with much more clarity, compassion, and peace. I go on to say, I knew when I heard young poets say in verse and conversation, I'm going to put you on pause, I heard their haiku nature, their haikuography. They were saying, I got to make you slow down and check out what's happening in your life in the world. So this haiku slows us down, makes us stay alive and breathe with that one breath that it takes to recite a haiku. This haiku, this tough form disguised in beauty and insight, is like the blue. For they both offer no solutions, only a pronouncement, a formal declaration, an acceptance of pain, humor, beauty and non-beauty, death and rebirth, surprise and life, always life. Both always help us to maintain memory and dignity. What I found in the HG bookshop then was extraordinary and ordinary. Silence, crystals, cornbread and greens, laughter, brocades, the sea, Beethoven and Coltrane, spring and winter, blue rivers, dreadlocks, blues, a waterfall, empty mountains, bamboo, bodegas, ancient generals, lamps, fireflies, Sarah Vaughan, her voice exploding in the universe, returning to earth in prayer, plum blossoms, silk and steel, Conte Hondo, wine, hills, flesh, perfume, a breath, inhaled and held silence, and I found that my mouth and the river are one and the same. I set sail in tall grass, no air stirs. And you see that there, you know, you got three lines, but I set sail, you know, in tall grass, right? No air stirs, but that's a haiku. And what we're saying simply, and we're teaching them simply that we are going to teach you not only the nature, the beauty in nature, but the beauty in the nature of yourself. And they're one and the same. So therefore, if I can teach, I go around with students teaching the haiku form now. And before I do anything, I teach them how to breathe from here.
From the diaphragm.
That's instead of from the chest, the throat, and the nose. And then I make them face each other, and I put my right hand on your heart. You put your right hand on my heart. Then I cover your hand. You cover my hand. Then I say, everybody keep quiet. We have got to hear each other's heartbeat. And that is bringing them to the haiku. The haiku makes you hear your own heartbeat and the heartbeat of nature and the heartbeat of other people. If I can make that class of junior high school students and high school students and college students hear each other's heartbeat, they will not be rough in a classroom. They will not curse each other out. Mm. They will not be envious, you know, because what we've done is that we've connected us. And the haiku connects us. Not only with nature, but the nature of ourselves, too.
How long have you been doing that with kids?
Oh, I've been doing that now, it seems like forever. The people who are writing haiku in these anthologies now, every one of them has studied with me. Because the first form I taught in my class was the haiku. But what I do now is like, this is like a class on the haiku. And I'm trying to show them that it has to do with breathing. It has to do with the heart, you know, and soul. And it has to do with you and nature. If you see a mother pulling a child along, you'd say, come on, hurry up. I got to get to work. I'm late. That's a haiku. And you don't laugh at her because you understand that connection that she has. That's an urban haiku, if you understand, you know, that. So that's what I'm trying to do, and I'm trying to get them to be quiet because poetry has reached a loud stage, but no one hears anything anyone's saying. All we do is that we do this. You know, we stamp our feet, and you don't hear what's being said. So therefore, you can't continue it. You know, you're looking for applause. The haiku does not look for applause at all. You know, it is a form that says, now you have to think about that. And in fact, what I always tell my students when we write, that long line of haiku sequence. Woo.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Right? You can do it backwards, too. And it's one and the same. That's how connected they are. So I will read a haiku if they're 10, but I'll also start at the last one and go all the way to the first and to show you how connected they are. You know, there's no disconnection with it at all.
Now, I have read a lot of what you've written over the last 30, 40 years. I've
read
a long time.
Right.
But there's something about where you are now with haiku and what it's how it's captured you in a way that's really very different.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, someone said to me in a long, 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 long interview, you don't write like you used to write in 1960s. I said, you're right. If I were to write like I wrote in the 1960s, you would have to say there's no progress being made.
Right.
I said, what happened to us, like every young group of people, you know, we found out we had been discriminated against. We were being discriminated against. We had been enslaved. No one had ever talked about it. So you can't come up and say, oh, you know, by golly, by gee, this morning I found out we had been enslaved. You know, we came out kicking and scrapping, you know.
That's right.
You know, we came out against everything. We were against the war. You know, we were against our parents. You know, we were against education. You know, we were against everything. And we were finally, trying to figure out how do we live well in this country. You know, we were trying to figure out how to answer the question, what does it mean to be human? You know, and we did it at the beginning in wild ways. You know, like, you know, we challenged everybody. I mean, I gave a talk recently to some executives, you know, a couple of blacks had been hired there, and they said, "Will you come give a talk?" And I'm thinking, "What more am I going to say to these people owning this big, you know, this big firm, right?" And I know they were nervous because, you know, I know they went someplace and said, "Oh,
the radical Sonia Sanchez is coming in." Uh-oh.
Right, right. But I went in, and I started out by saying, you know, probably maybe 10 years ago, probably I wouldn't have come in here to do this, but you know. What I recognize and realize is that we're all human beings, attempting to be human beings, trying to walk upright as human beings. And what I also realize that the people, I don't know what percentage anymore, we get it confused. Sometimes people say 7% who run the world and 13% who run the world. I said, what I know at some point, it's incumbent upon you to at some point realize that you have a lot of power and you must do much more good with your power. That if you are, it's probably in your hands to save this earth. You know, so you can't continue. And on many levels, I said, and these men got up, stood up and gave me a standing ovation because I wasn't slapping them or hitting them. I'm saying, but if you own what you own, at some point, you've got to figure out at some point, I really need for these men and women and children to live better than they're living. You know, I really do need to change how I look at them, you know, how I look at my employees also, too. I said, and I know that's hard because to own as much money as you own means that you are powerful, powerful people. And it means also, too, that power brings all kinds of arrogance. I am asking you at some point to drop those secret spells of power. And at some point, look at each other as other human beings. I said, you know why? I said, this world is not going to continue. This earth is looking at us saying simply, if you can't really get it together, I'm going to swallow all your so-and-so's whole, you know, and be willing to wait a billion of years. I mean, I said to them, it would take a billion years for a new species to come out of the sea and develop into what we call this so-called mankind and womankind. And if we know that much, why don't we just try to figure that out at some point? You know, and it was an interesting conversation there.
Do you think you were received by them?
Well, they gave me a standing ovation.
Do you think they heard you?
You know, I think some of them did. You know, I think it's one of those things you need to do. Like, I need to do workshops with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to. I need to go in and teach them how to breathe. Because when you teach someone how to breathe, you teach them life. You say you teach, and if you teach, the point of teaching these young people how to breathe is that you teach them how to breathe and they want life. They embrace life. They don't embrace death, you see. And that's what this is finally all about, you see, embracing life. And to take that to these great executives, you know, I'm asking them to embrace life too. You know, when you continue to really push people down and be superior, you know, you're dealing with death, not life. And that's a hard concept. I say it again. Now, I was going to sit down. I just said this about I want to write the guy who owns in the state of Washington, the guy who owns all of this.
Bill Gates.
Yeah, Gates. A letter, because they're talking about, you know, giving money to schools, for charter schools, but they give money with
strings.
With strings attached.
Right.
And my letter to him is that give the money and let the people report. No strings attached. Let that education go any way that it needs to go to educate people. You know, not what you think these children should be, not what you think how they should look, not what you think what they should learn, but let them. You see, that's what we've got to do. I mean, if you have this money, you've got to allow people to develop and come out and have faith that they will come out, you know, a certain
mm-hmm,
way.
Mm-hmm.
But you cannot say, I'm going to give this, now you must raise $1 million. If they had $1 million the first time around, they wouldn't have asked you for $1 million, you know. You know, but also to say that you must have this person for the chancellor or this person for, you know, whatever. No. Let these people decide in their communities how this education is going to go, you know, how they see it, what they want, you know. And so my friends, you know, who are all writers say, oh, Sonia, I say, yeah, I do write people. You know, I never get an answer. I write New York Times when they're wrong.
Oh, you've already written this letter. You wrote this letter to Bill Gates.
I'm going to write it.
You're going to write
it. Yeah, because I'm saying it now. When I say something out loud, it makes me do it.
Right,
you know,
right. I understand.
I said it to friends, you know,
and if I keep
saying it to friends, I won't do it. But if I said out loud on the radio, whatever, you know, I did it just recently at a reading. It means I have to do it now.
Right.
And I think that people need to write, you know, and say these kinds of things. They're important kinds of things. I mean, like I said that President Obama needs a cabinet, like Roosevelt had a cabinet. You know, not politicians. That's a whole nother different ballgame. He has politicians around him, but a cabinet that would say, like when Shirley Sherrod was accused of doing what she did.
Oh, my, it was
right?
horrible. Yes.
Well,
right.
Anybody in the movement knew who she was.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And who her husband was,
yeah,
who they both were.
Who he was, right.
Right.
I mean,
right.
And we knew them in SNCC, so we knew what they're about, so we knew exactly that the two of them would not, I mean, she would not have said what she said.
Right.
And all he had to do was call somebody and say, tell me about this Shirley Sherrod, tell me about her husband, right? And we would have said, right, oh, no, something, you need to investigate that further. And so you have an administration looking badly again because they don't investigate, or better, they don't have people around them who know, you know, who are aware, who've been, you know, who have years on them, you know, who've been around for a while and,
right.
and have dealt with each other. I mean, anybody in that movement could have said, oh, no, that couldn't have been President Obama. Right. But the people around him had no clue as to who she was or who her husband was and what SNCC was about. Right. And when Kwame Ture, you know, broke up, when that whole thing broke in the South, they stayed there and they continued to deal with whites in SNCC. You know, it was not that, like, that move towards just the Black Power.
If they just listened to her whole speech, they'd have known what she said.
Of course it was. If you can read. But
right.
What we're seeing, however, is how people are picking and choosing what they're putting on the radio and on the television, you see. And it's on purpose, you see. So we need people who are willing to sit and look and read and say, no, that's not the case.
We have to take a very brief
break.
Sure. And come right back. And we have Sonia Sanchez in the studio, and I have some emails coming in we want to read. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, www.umm.edu/heart. We will be right back with Sonia Sanchez. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are here today with the great Sonia Sanchez, who has, for the first time in 10 years, come out with a new book, Morning Haiku, and her book of plays came out this summer.
Oh, that's right. From Duke University Press. Right.
And, which I just got, which I haven't had a chance to go through yet. And next year, you come out with a book of essays, all the lectures you gave.
That's right.
Correct?
Right. Yeah, you got all that information.
So it's coming. It's coming. This is good.
Yeah, that is.
You can join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA-FM here at Morgan State University, 88.9 FM, and also on Free Speech TV all over the country. There's a phone call's coming in and an email. Let me read the email, then I get to the phone call with a question for you, and I have my and I'll throw in some of my own questions. Kimberly writes in, says, "Dear Mark, this is the first time I've been able to listen live in ages. What a treat to find Sonia Sanchez part of the show. I love your show, and a little bit of poetry was just what my soul needed today. Please ask the beloved writer to advise an overworked teacher like myself how to find the center of a storm so I can be more open and giving to my students. How does she do it?"
That's a wonderful question. And I don't know if she means how to find the center of the storm within herself or within the students. Or within the classroom.
Or survive within the center of this mad storm around us.
And I think how you do that is that at some point you've got to teach your students how to breathe, and you've got to learn how to breathe too. I think sometimes when we're in a classroom, we don't breathe. You know, we really don't breathe. So, you know, you really do have to try to teach them how to breathe, because they don't know how to breathe. You know, they don't even know, they don't even see life sometimes. You know, they're just like in a constant flow. They don't breathe. You know, you find them holding their breaths. So we got to make them stop. And sometimes a good way to start a class with them would be probably to read them a poem at the beginning of the class, something very meaningful for you and for them, too. And it sets the tone, for a class. And it puts what I call a breath and breathing back into the classroom. And I don't care what you're teaching. Sometimes, you know, whatever it is, it's important to grab that poem. I remember when 9/11 happened, I got calls in the morning for people asking me what poem should we read in order to get through. Not what essay, not what speech, but what poems do we read about death? Well, I did a number of poems. I actually read a poem about death that I had written to my father.
He was a teacher, wasn't he?
My father was a teacher and a musician. And I also read Dylan Thomas for them also, too, which I thought was important. But I didn't just stay on death. What I did is that I talked about life, and I read them Does Your House Have Lions? There's a section in there about my brother who died of AIDS, right?
Oh, right.
And there's sections in there about life. What life really is all about.
That's a lovely book.
Thank you, my brother. And I said, because we constantly want to go to a poem about death, but death always, for me, affirms life. You know, because I read a poem that I'd done for a student up at Amherst College, a young 17-year-old student who walked up to me. I was teaching at Amherst College. I had been kicked out of New York. And because, we were challenging everything, there in great liberal New York City, right? And I end up at Amherst College. And my first year, when the students come in August, and we have this huge reception for all the freshmen. And this young student by the name of Gerald Penny walked up to me and said, Professor Sanchez, I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm 17 years of age. My name is Gerald Penny, but I'm worth more than a penny. And I thought to myself, how corny. But I didn't say it to him, right? I shook his hand and said, welcome, welcome, welcome. But I lived on campus, and about a month later, I come home from the office and from teaching, and I was cooking dinner for my children, and there was a knock on the door, and I screamed, come in, because up at Amherst, no one locked doors at that time, right? And there was this silence, and I walked back to the door, and there were three students looking at me. Three African-American students said, Professor Sanchez, Gerald Penny drowned in the pool. And I called my babysitter from Smith College, and she came, and we went, and I saw him, stretched out, and I thought, you're not as tall as you were stretched out on this floor. And, we had to begin to deal with what do we do? And the president asked me to call his mother. He said he couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. And so I went back to my office with all these students, and I picked up. I had the number. I dialed the number, and after three rings, I hung up. I couldn't do it. I dialed again, and I hung up. I couldn't do it. And by the third time, I had all these students looking at me, and I knew that I couldn't keep doing that with them.
Right.
So a young voice came on the phone, and I said, "Oh," I said, "my name is," and I said my name, and I said, "Who are you?" And it was a young Penny, and so I said, "Oh," I said, "you," and I said, "Are there many Pennies there?" And she said, "Oh, there are lots of us." And in some kind of very strange way, it made it easier for me to bring death to a family that had many children as opposed to a family that had maybe just one son. But I read that poem that I was trying to remember a line of that poem, but at the moment of birth is death. You know, and that's what we have to teach always and understand. And at the center of that storm is peace. But what we have to do when we teach in a classroom is hard work, but we have to insist that peace is there at the center of that storm. And sometimes we have to insinuate peace, you know, among and amid our students. And sometimes we have to insinuate peace among ourselves. So I know when I get up in the morning, I do breathing exercises, and I have a little book by my bed. And my morning ritual is to write a haiku. I write a haiku every morning, and what that does is that it brings me, you know. And then I go out and do my 3 miles on the, you know, on the field, on the track, right? But the point is simply that you have got to do that. You've got to find a way to bring that peace within ourselves.
Sonia Sanchez is with us. She's bringing a haiku to all of us. 410-319-8888 number here. And Melissa, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Melissa.
I'm enjoying this show. I'm such a huge fan. I loved your book of poetry, like the singing coming off the drum.
Oh, the love poems, right.
Yes, I give it as a gift to everyone all the time.
Thank you, my sister.
I love, I'm really going to go back and revisit that book after hearing you talk about haikus. The poems in that book appeal to me because it's almost like the quietness of the haiku allowed you to fill in the silence with your own feelings. And I just love that. But I'm getting a different perspective hearing you talk about it.
Well, you know what else what else that haiku does? It not only makes us stay alive and breathe with that breath because we enter that haiku, right? But when you begin to think in the form, right? Not about writing a haiku, right? You begin to model yourself after the form. You become mindful of nature, mindful. See, once I become mindful of myself, then I must become mindful of other people. And so that made me walk into a class 20 years ago and say, "Good morning, my brothers and sisters." And people said, "Whoa, hold it. We're not all brothers and sisters in here. We all look different." And I said, "No, we're not. We are all brothers and sisters." And I made them take a leap with me. You know, that's what we have to do. We have got to make people take a leap of faith in a classroom with each other. And they might get nervous initially because I know by December they will all be in that mix of all with brothers and sisters. And until we begin to force people, you know, in a quiet fashion to see themselves in each other, we're not going to have peace on this earth. You know, and this whole thing is about finally making us have peace. That's why, but a couple of years ago, I got arrested with the grannies. You know, we went into a recruitment center and said, "Take us, don't take our children and grandchildren." And the guy looked up and said, "Oh, hello, whatever." But, you know, we began to talk to the young men and women who were filling out forms. They're going to join. And one of the young men said to me, "Well," they said, if I came here and joined, I could become a doctor." I said, "Well, I can introduce you to doctors at the med school, you know, here at UPenn, at Temple, you know, all over the city. But, you know, I don't want you to discover geography, you know, in a foreign place when your head hits the ground. down, you know, and you're dead. I said, I want us to move in a peaceful way. So when the people started to leave, then they said, well, you have got to go. You know, they actually told us, and we said, we don't want to go. We want to stay, you know, and talk to you. And finally, they called the police, and the police came. And they took us out the back door. There was a young woman there from NPR, and she screamed towards the back. She said, Professor Sanchez, suppose you had gone to boot camp, what would you have done? And I said, I would have done push-ups, you know, for peace. That every day we have to do push-ups for peace. And it is an exercise. And when to write a haiku every morning is an exercise in peace for me. It's an exercise in breathing. It's an exercise of life. It's an exercise of saying you must stay connected to people, not only to the earth, but to people who walk on this earth also. So I thank you, my dear sister, for that, no, for your comments.
I'm wondering with this book, this new haiku mm-hmm. that you've just mm-hmm. written, and all the things you've written in the past and right. the paths you've taken to get here. I mean, right. in the 60s, I mean, you were in the Nation of Islam for a while.
That's right. Because Malcolm influenced everybody.
Right.
Right, yes.
Even me.
Yes.
Even
Well, you know, when we first saw Malcolm, he was talking to all white students.
He was.
I mean, honestly.
Right, exactly.
Right, yeah. And they were cheering him. And we're sitting there looking at this guy saying, you know, my father said you can't listen to him. You can't listen to him. It's amazing.
He was an amazing human being.
He was an amazing human being. You're right.
And I wonder, in all these years, and now you've come to this world of haiku and you're in this spiritual place, clearly you're finding yourself in as place of growth from where you were in mm-hmm. 1964 or 1971
right.
or any of those
right.
times.
Right.
So I'm curious what you think about that era and where we are now. I mean, uh-huh. you fought against racism, you fought against sexism, you've just been a fighter your
right.
whole life.
Right.
But there's something about you at the moment that there's a peace coming out of you, a feeling of peace that's kind of
right.
emanating from you now. I'm curious about where you are and where you think we are at the moment.
Well, you know what we did in those early years, that if someone said something smart, we said something smart back.
Right.
I come from
right.
New York, and like we knew how to slice you up and watch you collapse, you know. Like people just, you know, we would say something, but our words were like swords, you know what I mean? We slice people up and watch the person just back away. But it didn't change anything. And so what I began to learn from travel and study at the same time is that, you know, there are real connections there. There are real turns. After my second book, there was a turn when I did things for children. There was a turn when I did things called a blues book for Blue Black Magical Women. There was a turn when I did two or three other books, and I began to write. There were turns I was making, and that came primarily from, first of all, from my teaching. I used to say, I just wish I could just stay home and write, because, you know, my writing has always been troubling in the sense that I've had to write from, you know, putting the kids down to bed, you know, putting clothes in the washing machine, sometimes running out to the corner doing that, getting food ready for the next day, grading papers, and then writing. So I would write from about 1 o'clock until about 3:30 in the morning, and then and then go to sleep in my study, right? And then get up at 6:30 to turn the heat on and to get them ready, feed them, and take them to school. Now, you know, I mean, that's a hard way of doing things. But the point is that if you're a writer, I tell young writers, they tell me, oh, I have all this work to do. I say, yeah. And what else is new? You know, we all have to do this. So you go ahead and you do it. So we did that kind of thing, that kind of motion and movement. But all the while you were learning, you were looking, and you were teaching. And I'm not a revisionist. So therefore, I was on stages when people look at someone and say, oh, that person was like this. You know, talking about someone being gay. Everybody fell out laughing. I fell out laughing, too. Except as I laughed, I remembered. Now, that's not my student in my classroom, Mark. Mark's not like that. I mean, Mark doesn't act like that. You know, Mark, we treat Mark with great respect mm-hmm. in the classroom. And that's what I meant. The teaching and being with students. I taught all kinds of students who came into my class. And one thing in my class, you couldn't disrespect anybody.
You cannot,
you cannot disrespect
right.
anyone, not at all. That's even in criticizing or looking at a poem, right? In no way, you know, can you do that. And so one day on stage, when someone did that, I stood up and said, that's not funny. And all heck broke loose. You know, and I was like, not invited here, there, every which way. I mean, And it's just, I've had a hard life on many levels because I took stands on certain things.
You were not invited many places. You had to leave New York and go to Amherst because of racism and all the other things that you faced then, right?
To teach. So, but I did that, and I pushed people. And the joy is that the students understood it. The students love you for it because they saw it as protecting them, you know, standing up for them. When they didn't have a voice, you gave them voice. And that's what I did. You know, I gave voice. And the book to my brother was in terms of that, too. It was a love poem to him. I said to my dad, I said, you know, I'm writing a book about Wilson, your son, my brother. And my father said to me, he was ill at the started that beginning of that illness that finally he would die from. And he said to me, well, you can't write a poem about your brother without writing about me. And I'm stretched out on the couch, you know, because it's just at the beginning of this illness. And I said, no, what do you mean? And he said, you can't write about him without writing about me, too. Well, you got to know me. He said, and I hope when you write about me this time, I hope you get me right. And I sat up and looked at him, and he began to talk to me the first time about my mother, his wife. That's why in this in that book, the section called Father's Voice, that is a love poem to my father of understanding who he was, what he went through, how he did it, how he survived. This is quite different from the first poem I wrote to him, which is a poem that was a very rough poem about my father and all the women he had. So this is what you do. If you understand, you know, that you look up at the world, you learn, and you're not a human being unless you change with that information.
Right.
This is not about taking in information and saying, well, I'm going to stay the same. You take in information, and the information I took in about my students was information that made me extend my hands and say, come on, come into my classroom. I will protect you here. Once I protect you, once I teach you, it's incumbent upon you to go out also, you know, and teach. You just can't say, well, I got protected in here. I'm okay. And I'm going to stay here. No, no, no. Once I teach you, you'll graduate. You go out into the world and do this. So I have a lot of these students who are writing now are former students of mine. And they're making plenty of money, most of them, right? Because I didn't insist that they had to be political like me. Well, I insisted that they had to be human, however. You know, sometimes you have people who are not willing to risk a job, you know, or risk a life or risk being voided or whatever, okay? But they are willing to be a quiet energy, you know, that would be there for students, you know, to teach. Right, to propel them, you know, to be a mentor, to make sure they know how to write well, to make sure that they do this well on this earth. That's important, and that's what I say in class. You know, you don't have to be radical like me. That's not a prerequisite coming to my class. What I insist, however, whatever it is that you do it well. You know, that's what this is finally all about.
In the book, we only have we only have 5 minutes left. Mm. I haven't begun to ask a question yet.
Mm.
Do we have time? Do you think we have time to do Max Roach?
Yeah, I'd love to do the Max Roach piece. You know, and the last one I told you is inscribed on his tombstone.
Right.
10 haiku for Max Roach. 1. Nothing ends. Every blade of grass, remembering your sound. Your sounds exploding in the universe return to earth in prayer. As you drummed, your hands kept reaching for God. God, 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 God. The morning sky so lovely imitates your laughter. You came warrior clear, your music kissing our spines, feet tapping, singing, impeach our blood. You came drumming sweet life on sails of flesh. Da a boom ah, da a boom ah, da a boom ah. Your fast beat riding the air settles in our bones. Ah, do ah, da ah, oh, da da ah, do da ah, do da 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 ah, do da 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 boom ah, da boom da da boom da da boom da da boom. Your drums soloing our breaths unto the beat, unbeat, unto the beat, unbeat unto the beat, unbeat. Your hands shimmering on the legs of rain. Your hands. Shimmering on the legs of rain for the great Max Roach.
Yeah. That's so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
So beautiful. And you told me before we went on the air, but you didn't, that our audience doesn't know, that part of this haiku is...
The last one is inscribed on his tombstone. And I always tell people they need to go up to Woodlawn Cemetery because they'll see, you know, all these greats there from the Duke, you know, to Miles, to Illinois Jacquet. And even on the side is the great Celia Cruz.
Oh,
yeah. Oh,
really?
She has a crypt there with her husband.
Really?
In fact, I was there with Max's daughter, Maxine Roach, you know, who's a great musician also, too. And it's so big, I said, if this economy continues to be as bad as it is, people will move into that crypt, you know, being a little Bunsen burner, you know.
So where,
it's Woodlawn.
But before we, we have to leave, so where's Abby Lincoln buried? Do you know?
They just I missed that. I was traveling at the time, you know, but I can find that out. They just had a memorial for her, and I don't know if she went to Woodlawn or not.
Woodlawn as well.
But I will find out.
Because you dedicated the book to Abby Lincoln.
Oh, did I? Isn't that some quote that she did there, you know? But I dedicated this book to Gugi Wa Thiong'o, the great Kenyan, and his wife, Jerry. But there's this
epigram.
This epigram that she said, the best thing you can do is to be a woman and stand before the world and speak your heart.
Which you have done.
Thank you, my dear brother.
Which you have done.
Thank you so very much.
It's been a pleasure. I just love having you in the studio.
Oh,
thank you so much.
It's a pleasure being here, my dear brother. Keep up the good work.
We will do that.
Okay.
And you can find out more about Sonia Sanchez. Go to our website, steinershow.org. See where she'll be speaking and the honor she's receiving from First Person Arts. In Philadelphia in November 14th. That'll all be on our website.
Oh, hi, nice. Thank you. And I'll send that to you, too. Okay.
Please do.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. I remind you all that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, go to www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns today are Jake Mendelson and Will Mason. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out about our guests, visit us on the website at steinershow.org. Visit us tomorrow night at the New York Pratt Central Library, 7 p.m. here in Baltimore. I'll be on stage with Anthony McCarthy and Amy Goodman. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for Free Speech Television, I'm Mark Steiner.